This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Our radio show is heard on Pacifica stations nationwide, and you can watch our TV show on Free Speech TV and on our website. Thousands of students at University of California, Berkeley recently protested the scheduled appearance on their campus of notorious Trump supporter and Breitbart columnist Milo Yiannopoulos. Yiannopoulos has made a name for himself by resorting to shocking language to disparage women, attack feminism, and even gay rights, despite being an openly gay man himself. He's been banned from Twitter permanently for violating their guidelines. Still, he was given a $250,000 book deal by Simon & Schuster and had appearances planned at both UC Berkeley and UCLA. Both campus events have now been canceled, but the book deal remains. My guest is Melissa Figueroa. She is a PhD candidate in geography at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also a producer at KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. She served as the press director for Jill Stein's 2016 campaign and is the executive producer of the Green News Network. And she's a correspondent for this program. Welcome back to the show, Melissa.
Thank you, Sonali. Great to be here.
So you were at the protests. Before we get into why people were protesting and what the impact was, just describe for us how it played out, what it looked like. I know a lot of people have been focusing on some fires that were set, and it's easy to just condemn the entire action as violent. But you were there. How did it play out?
So I approached the demonstration sort of from the backside of it. I was coming from our department, which was on the north side of campus, going towards the south side. So in that sense, I was a little farther away from the sort of frontline action, as maybe some other people were. But what I saw when I got there was, and I think I came by like sort of right at the moment where there were a couple of police confrontations, there were some chanting, and that they had sort of just a few minutes after I got there is when they announced that the event itself was going to be canceled, and then there was this huge cheer that came up through the crowd. But what I saw more than anything was the, you know, probably about 2,000 students, faculty members, and community members who had come out in solidarity with the people who were being targeted by Milo and by Breitbart and by the fascist right that was coming to this campus. And, you know, what I saw was a really strong and peaceful and powerful refusal to allow this kind of open, basically open organizing for hatred to occur within the confines of our campus, and people standing up for that, and people standing up for the rights of undocumented students, of trans students, of all of these people that have been targeted by Milo's movement, and a huge show of solidarity. So, you know, it could be the angle that I came from, in that, you know, I did not see, later I actually saw some of the aerial views in which, you know, I saw some of the actions that the Black Bloc or the sort of more militant factions of this crowd did. But what I saw for the most part was a huge show of solidarity, a huge show of protest, of nonviolent protest, and you know, after the event was canceled, there was a dance party. So there was also a bit of jubilation in the air.
Now, Melissa, I understand that Milo's campus speech, the speech that he had planned for that event, officials at UC Berkeley warned that he might use that speech to target undocumented folks, to show their images and give out information about themselves, about them?
Yes. So what one of the things that I guess that he was going to announce that night was that he had been joining forces with the David Horowitz Freedom Center, which, as some people may know, is also a right wing organization connected with Israeli Zionists that have been targeting BDS protesters on campus. And that this new initiative that they were going to announce was going to be attacking the sanctuary campus movement, of which Berkeley is a part. And we now have some evidence that has come out that UC Berkeley learned, also from the Breitbart's own promotion of the event, that he would possibly be releasing the information of undocumented students and identifying them on campus, just as, you know, I think activists connected with them, with that movement, had also released the public, the private information of some of the protest organizers in the days leading up to the event. So this was not just about shutting down, you know, Milo's free speech, or that we were going to hear some kind of reasoned argument from the conservative right. We were, you know, literally trying to protect the safety of both the organizers and undocumented students on campus that night.
So let's talk about what it is he spews and represents. I mean, for those people who aren't aware of the kinds of things that Milo Yiannopoulos has said, he lost, I understand, his Twitter privileges by lobbing racist and sexist attacks against actress Leslie Jones for being on Ghostbusters. And his writings on Breitbart are just kind of mind-blowing. But when you read them, you can kind of tell that he's, you know, he seems to be trying to get a rise out of people. He's essentially looking for attention, and he knows that when he says shocking things, he'll get it, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Again, this is almost how we have seen the popularity and the rise of Donald Trump in this election.
Yeah.
That, you know, they know that as long as they can shock and, you know, have that shock value and disgust value, that they'll at least get airtime and attention. So this is,
and then they end up basically attracting people like themselves, narcissistic egomaniacs, to support them. I mean, Milo is a leader of the so-called men's rights movement. He's declared his birthday the World Patriarchy Day. Despite being an openly gay man, he said gay rights are bad for folks, that they're making gay people dumber. He's held up a sign saying, deport all fat people. He's a fat shamer. I mean, obviously he's doing this to upset folks. He surrounds himself with pictures of himself at speaking events, so he loves having all this attention. And I had to sort of think twice about whether I wanted to cover this story, and I've been avoiding covering who this person is because I think he thrives on the attention. However, the protest is now a big enough news story. How important is it, Melissa, for us to shut these people up rather than just letting them have their say and trying to ignore them?
Well, there's a couple of things about that. And I think part of what his agenda might be is precisely to test the limits of, you know, what we consider the norms and the sort of legal rights of free speech. He's definitely pushing the boundaries of that. But, you know, I also want to, you know, remind people that both within the law and in institutions, you know, there is a line that is drawn between free speech and in the spirit of having a debate and an exchange of ideas. When that crosses into uncivil debate and where actual people's safety comes into question.
I mean, you can't scream fire in a crowded theater. You don't have a free speech right to do that, we know.
That's right. That's right. Nor do you have, you know, a right to say, you know, like, that person, go beat up that person, you know, when you're actually trying, when you're inciting violence against other people.
Which is essentially what he did to Leslie Jones, right, on Twitter. Didn't he essentially sic his supporters on her? And she was inundated with the most vile, hateful, racist abuse that I've seen in a long time. Essentially, that's what he did, right? She was given death threats.
That's right. That's right. And the same thing happened to some of the organizers of the protest, here in Berkeley, where, you know, people from the alt-right, people in that movement were doxxed, basically. What that's the practice of releasing the contact information, public and the private information of certain people, and for, you know, no other purpose but for harassment. And that's exactly what some of the organizers of the event, as I've heard, did. And they actually read some of their death threats aloud to the Berkeley administration in a last-ditch attempt to get them to shut down the event.
How do you assess the position that UC Berkeley took? The chancellor of the university, Nicholas Dirks, had to walk a fine line. He basically, you know, said that the campus organizers had the right to hold the event. But then he put out a statement saying, nothing we have done to plan for this event should be mistaken as an endorsement of Yiannopoulos' views or tactics. Indeed, we are saddened that anyone would use degrading stunts or verbal assaults on marginalized members of our society to promote a political platform. Is that a balanced view, or could he have been much stronger and simply said, no, actually, we can just turn this person away?
Well, you know, I think from the if I'm trying to sort of try and look at it through the point of view of the institution and the administration, I'm sure they felt that they were attempting to be fair to and follow sort of the free speech guidelines, especially as that was something that was, again, that Milo himself and this movement has kind of elevated as the justification for them to be able to say what they want. I know for a fact, I mean, I was not involved in the organizing myself, but I do know that for months, people on campus, you know, hundreds of students, faculty, administrators had pushed for months through every possible channel to cancel the event, including official letters, including meetings with administration, and including union grievances, phone calls. And again, in the week leading up to the protest, the people who had received death threats actually, you know, bringing that up to the administration. Apparently, the organizers were told by the administration that it would take a immediate threat to public safety, like a riot or a threat to cancel the event. And so, you know, it part of, I think, where the property discussion, where the property destruction part of the protest came into play. Again, I was not involved with that, so I can't tell you, you know, definitively. But it did feel like, while I was there, that the property destruction was aimed at creating exactly that public safety sort of crossing that threshold in order for them to cancel the event.
You know,
and I
Melissa,
that's how
sorry,
what
go
they're
ahead.
Just. For, and I believe that's what their justification was for canceling the event.
So someone posted a point on Twitter that those who are saying this should have been an entirely peaceful protest, someone posted a picture of the infamous UC Davis cop pepper spraying people peacefully engaging in a sit-in a few years ago as, you know, this is what the UC system does to peaceful nonviolent protesters. And I'm wondering what you make of that, because it's true. You know, whenever people say, well, your protest needs to be far less inconvenient. Well, when it's convenient, it stops being a protest.
That's right. Well, I mean, yeah, that's absolutely a great point. You know, that you can protest, you know, as in you can express your disapproval or express your concerns with a certain type of thing. But, you know, but a lot of civil disobedience protests throughout history have been aimed not simply at expressing your disapproval, but actually blocking the injustices at hand by disruption. That's precisely what, you know, when Martin Luther King marched over the Edmund Pettus Bridge, he was blocking a highway, right? And people at the lunch counters were disrupting the normal operation of segregated businesses. There's a component to civil disobedience that is precisely this, aimed at disrupting the injustices and not allowing injustices to go forward. So, you know, we could have, and as you pointed out, and as has been pointing out on Facebook, when we have protest completely peacefully, and you know, what we have gotten is violence aimed against us because of it. And I will also tell you that I have also heard and saw at the protest the other day that Milo supporters and other fascist supporters were going throughout the crowd, getting into people's faces, yelling, trying to provoke fights. And I saw them doing this for, you know, better part of an hour without anybody, you know, actually rising to that and touching them. There were a couple of fights that did start to break out because people were being extremely aggressive and violent towards us. But, you know, and this goes to the other point about the objective of this protest was to shut down this event because we knew that people were going to be targeted. We knew that there was going to be harmful things said. There was going to be things that would be said that would incite violence against people on campus. And what are you going to do about that? You know, are you going to stand by and cluck your head, clutch your pearls, shake your head and say no while that actually goes on and those people get harmed anyway? Or are you going to actually try to physically resist and block and protect those people from actually being targeted in the way that they were? You know, one of the organizers told me that in the days following the shutdown, you know, many immigrant, queer, trans students of color have remarked that they haven't felt this safe in weeks. And, you know, I say as a person of color that, you know, I felt very, very proud that night that I live in a place and work and study in a place like Berkeley, where I know that if they came for me and I was to be targeted, then I knew that these thousands of people would come out to protect me too.
I mean, Milo Yiannopoulos certainly has his right to free speech, but so do the students of the campus he's speaking at. And essentially, that's what people engaged in their right to free speech, in expressing their opposition at the UCLA event, which, by the way, there was a mass protest being organized at the campus of UCLA here in Southern California, where I am. That event has been canceled. They're claiming that, that it was because the university couldn't accommodate the tech requirements of Milo's operation. Let's talk about the Simon & Schuster deal, Melissa. Simon & Schuster, very, very reputable publisher, gave him a $250,000 deal for a book. I don't know how many people, you know, get such deals. People far more qualified to actually write books than this Breitbart columnist, who, if you read the quality of his writing, forget about the content, you wonder, you know, how he gets published. But the Simon & Schuster defended their decision, saying that they want to make it clear, we do not support or condone, nor will we publish hate speech, not from our authors, not in our books, not at our imprints, not from our employees, and not in our workplace. This wasn't good enough for bad feminist author Roxane Gay, who basically said she was pulling her book deal, and she's a big deal. She is a writer of some serious reputation. She said, I'm not going to be published by, I'm not going to let Simon & Schuster publish my book if they're going to go ahead and give this much money and a deal to Milo Yiannopoulos. What do you make of this whole tussle? Should Simon & Schuster not have, you know, done this?
Well, Simon & Schuster is a corporation. And they're a capitalist corporation. And just as Les Moonves, who was the executive president of CBS, said about Trump, that, you know, they may not like what they say, but it's sure good for business. And I would say probably from the point of view of a corporation like Simon & Schuster, that, you know, even though they say that they won't publish hate speech, which I'm not sure where they're drawing that line, especially given the fact that, you know, there's very obvious hate speech that has come out in Milo's writings and speeches, and also people who have actually come to physical harm because of it. Let's not forget that at the University of Washington, just a couple of weeks ago, someone was actually shot at one of his events over this. I'm sure that they gave such a great, huge advance to this person because they knew that they were going to make a lot of money off of it. And, you know, I don't know whether or not And I would, you know, I would not make that decision myself, because I knew that no matter what kind of money I made, you know, off of that, that those ideas would end up having a greater platform than ever before. But, you know, then again, I'm not the executive of Simon & Schuster. So,
well, thank you for mentioning the Washington incident, by the way. That's right. I failed to mention that a University of Washington student was the person who actually shot a person protesting the Yiannopoulos event. Just going to show the potential for violence when this person makes his way around university campuses, thanks to the enrichment by Simon & Schuster. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today. I hope to have you back on the program regularly in the future.
Great. Thank you so much, Sonali.
Melissa Figueroa is a PhD candidate in geography at the University of California at Berkeley. She's a producer at KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. She served as the press director for Jill Stein's 2016 campaign and is the executive producer of the Green News Network. She's also a correspondent for this program. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can sign up for our newsletter at risingupwithsonali.com to get daily emails with links to all our stories.